Kiamanuia, this is Jeff Phillips Weverson recording this broadcast of On the Brink Radio, number 287. It's Thursday, I think it's the 19th of July. I'm atop Memory Island, Memory Rock here at Orfara Bay, otherwise known as Medlands Beach here on Atea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. My very, very favorite place and most powerful place in the whole Southern Hemisphere. Place, this particular beach of my most intensive and profound encounters with dolphins. This show is about artwork, about visual art, about painting, visual images, and specifically about my art. And it's one of the main concepts of the show is called the New Dreaming, in the sense of the dreaming of the ancestors of the Australian Indigenous people, and the very high compliment that Barbara Randall, widow of Uncle Bob Randall, who was one of the custodians of Uluru, a very major elder of the Central Desert people of Australia, she told me that I was painting and bringing forth the new dreaming, which is, it's like a whole new paradigm, a whole new incarnation of reality for humanity in the world, in the belief system of who are by far the oldest continually existing human culture on the planet, the First Nations Australians. So we're basically talking about, I'm not going to try to cover the whole philosophy of art and what visual imagery is. We're talking about patterns that we see with our eyes. Visual images created by our optical and neurological systems that are normally throughout the history of our existence and the history of every being that's had an eye, which we believe the earliest eyes were simple compound eyes that the trilobites had hundreds of millions of years ago as they walked around down at the bottom of the ocean. Then these evolved into the compound eyes of insects and I don't know, the history of the eye would be a very interesting topic for a show in itself. But at the same time, I'm using language to talk about vision. In a way, it's kind of like Steve Martin, the comedian and musician, who said that talking about music is like dancing about architecture. So, in a way, I'm using one kind of form of communication to describe another. But since this is a talk radio show, and even though Jill Stanley at UCY occasionally lets me do the nonverbal talk radio using sound and music, I can't really send out visual images or pictures of my art on the radio. I guess I could if it was all encoded in binary form, kind of like the Arecibo transmission that they sent out in 1973. To the constellation Hercules. They broadcast this digital message through the Arecibo radio telescope. Very interesting thing in itself. So we've got everything that we see, which is imagery being created in real time, which until humans started creating artifacts, everything we saw was things that occurred in the natural world. Plants, animals, stars, rocks, river, plants, fellow beings, celestial phenomenon, all the archetypes of nature is mainly what we saw. And then we started creating objects, tools, possibly musical instruments, and then we evolved into making pictures, which is probably one of the earliest things that people did in terms of art. But how they thought of it is something that we'll probably never understand. It probably wasn't just to be making a pretty picture. It probably, or we like to think, that it had some kind of very serious cosmological and spiritual dimension to it, possibly shamanic But, you know, there's no way to really know for sure. I remember my friend Robert Bednarik, the epistemologist, rock art researcher in Melbourne. He's one of the top rock art people in the world. And he said the last thing any credible rock art researcher would try to do is to try to decode or decipher what any sort of rock art meant, because he thinks that would be absolutely impossible. What you try to do is determine its authenticity and its age, for example, to begin with. So then you've got the evolution of people making pictures. And this might be bark paintings, it might be sand paintings, it might be petroglyphs etched on rocks, which is a whole story in itself. And what these images are and what they meant is a vast area for research and investigation. And it's interesting because these forms, especially the rock art, tends to have the greatest longevity of any kind of art forms that humans have engaged in so far. Then we've got the advent of painting that was possibly ornamental, possibly served as decor for the ruling class, maybe like in ancient China, or what's a more ancient culture than there? The ancient Egyptians and the Babylonians, they were big into their art. Big, with gold and very, very, very ornate temples and stuff like that. And even if there were no hieroglyphics, this art is still very sort of geometrical and stylized. And if you want to look at it from the point of view of sacred geometry and that kind of thing, there's probably whole universes of information contained in there if you wanted to adopt that kind of algorithmic cognitive approach and start mapping out all the angles and mapping out what it might have stood for. You know, like that, you could say, like, this pattern here is the same as the belt and the constellation of Orion, and this is the distance between these two stars mapped out between these two pyramids. And people like Graham Hancock have been doing stuff like that. And sure, I mean, you know, I think you can find whatever you're looking for in exercises like that. You could really map anything onto anything and find a correspondence if that's what you want to do. That's not what this show is about. I'm looking at the sort of very, very brief evolution of modern art. So we've gone from the traditional sacred art of indigenous people that possibly didn't even have houses to live in or walls to hang anything on. And then you've got the art of the, like, ancient Egyptians, which was in tombs and temples. And then maybe in other civilizations too, other cultures, they had the equivalent. And then you've got, like, ancient Chinese silk painting, and then you had the evolution of writing with the calligraphic writing in China, and then things like the Book of Kells. But before that, you would have had people doing paintings. Now, I'm not sure what they would say. I've never studied art. My background's in science. So if you studied the history of art, you might know who was the first culture that had, like, paintings that just were sort of ornamental, like maybe portraits or landscapes or something like that, that people would, maybe the ruling class would have, or the people would do for different kind of ways. But then, you know, you think of, like, the Middle Ages and the Renaissance as sort of like the golden age of painting. You've got all the portraits of the famous people and the Mona Lisa and all the different kind of stuff that Leonardo da Vinci did and Michelangelo. And then you've got the evolution of the whole different European schools of art. You know, you've got Impressionism and Cubism and, I mean, you know, there's a million different schools. And all that has led up to the world of today, in which we have all kinds of stuff that people call art that's being mass-produced and sent out on the internet and as reproductions. And people might have a poster of a Van Gogh painting that's selling tennis shoes, you know, and we've just become saturated with all this stuff, and we've become blind to it. But the true meaningful dimensions of visual art to me are color and the sort of the harmony of the patterns, the shapes and the forms and the relationship between them, Now, I never studied art. I started out as a scientist, first studying physics and astronomy, and then zoology and psychology, as I fell in love first with the stars and then with the whales and dolphins in the ocean. And I started doing still photography in 1970 and have continued to this day. So I've come at being a visual artist not ever having studied art, which I think is a really, really good thing. I studied science and I studied photography, or practiced all these, and I think that these have influenced my art a lot. And I've never tried to paint the kinds of things that people who studied art learn how to do, like portraits and shading and shadows and realistic looking plants and animals and 3D and all this kind of stuff. You know, I got like, there's plenty of people that can do that, that are really good at it. And then also I can just take a picture of something if I want a very realistic image, or, you know, you can get other people to do this kind of stuff. So I've tended to do my own kind of thing. But I guess where I started as a painter was in 1978. I had just kind of given up on college, studying zoology and psychology, and was beginning my preparation, or I had been in a two-year preparation of preparing to do some psychedelic substances that I was going to try to consciously use to enhance my creativity and to expand my mind, to reprogram myself of anything that wasn't working, and to try to go to the next level. And I made a conscious effort to tell myself that I wanted to work equally in words, visuals, and music. And I'd been preparing myself for 2 years. And around this time, I think it was in March of 1978, I first did a psychedelic. I took some mescaline on a full moon. And that was a pretty transformative experience. It was a pretty small dose, but I still felt it. But very interesting. Well, around that time, some friends of mine were design students at NC State University. And they said, Jeff, we're taking a painting course as part of our graphic design training. And I go, like, you know, you should try it. And I go, like, well, they go, like, yeah, just get some paint and sit down and try it. So I did. I went and bought some paint and sat down and just started painting. Had no idea what I was going to do or how to do it, or didn't even think of what I was going to paint, but I mixed the paint and sat down and just started painting, and I was blown away because it was just like it was already in me and it just wanted to come out. I mean, I'm not saying I channeled it, but it's like I just put the paint brush to the paper and these images just came out. And I remember my very, 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 very first painting of all was highly geometrical because I had already learned how to do drafting, like drawing the blueprints for houses and stuff from my dad many years before. So I did a very first painting that was quite like that. It had me, had a tiny little human figure sitting on the edge of a high-tech looking precipice. It was like a plane, like a desert plane with an abyss dropping down into a river valley, but it looked like it was mechanical, made of beams or piano keys. Like I was sitting on the edge of a giant piano keyboard that dropped off into an abyss with a river, and then there was a sort of a plateau-like triangle that went up into the eye of this big orange kind of yellow sun-like eyeball thing. And I'm sitting there, this little silhouetted figure sitting there on the brink reading a book. And there's also the shadow of a cactus. So it's like I'd been reading some Carlos Castaneda at the time. So I guess there's a good bit of that in this. But anyway, that's my very first painting. But then my next few were completely different. They were very impressionistic. Really, the only truly impressionistic ones I've ever done were I just sort of blobbed paint on there. But these landscapes came out. And one of them just where I made an accidental movement with my hand and it looked exactly like a tornado. And it was just blowing me away. And so I fell in love with painting, and it was like there was so much in me that just wanted to come out. It was like it was coming from a deep level of my unconscious. I didn't think of even from previous lifetimes, but there was one of my very earliest ones that I did that I've actually got on the wall here on Great Barrier Island, and it's a kind of a night landscape with a full moon and a sort of a gnarly looking tree with no leaves and kind of figures in the foreground that could kind of be interpreted as a bunch of people sort of moving along, but they're kind of hunkered down, and it's at night, and it's not exactly gloomy, but there's kind of this wispy beams of stuff floating around the moon. And I remember that I think I was going to call this painting Oppression. But this might have harkened back to some of the early Emanuel Velikovsky books that I would have read around the same time when I fell in love with astronomy and started doing photography around 1968, 1970. So I just kept on painting and painting for the next couple of years, and then, and only after I'd only been painting about a year or two, like, I just came up with all different kind of stuff. Out of, I'd never looked at other artists. I never studied art. I just sort of was coming up with stuff out of my head, and I decided to do something that was kind of just like a field of squiggles. I called it visual noise. Well, anyway, I was living in Richmond, Virginia at the time, and my friend was studying at the university. And her friend was the head of the art department. And he came over one day and looked at this painting I did, and he goes, "Oh my God, Jeff, you're the Kandinsky of today." And I go, like, "Well, thanks, but I have no idea what that means." But that was in 1979, and so later on, I went and looked up some stuff about Kandinsky. He was a very well-known Russian artist from about, you know, the early 1930s, 40s, 50s in there. But they call him the father of abstraction. And so apparently he was the first modern artist to go away from painting portraits and landscapes and trees and flowers and flower pots and stuff. And he started painting abstract fields of images with, like, geometrical shapes, patterns, symbols, glyphs, but non-representational. So he was the father of painting stuff that doesn't look like something you could see. And for me to be compared to him, or much less called the Kandinsky of today, that was an extraordinarily high compliment coming from the head of an art department at a university. The University of Richmond. I can't remember this guy's name. But anyway, only many, many, many years later did I go back and actually read up on who Kandinsky was. I looked at some of his stuff, and I could see kind of a, you know, a similarity visually to some of the stuff I was doing. But my stuff is more kind of like scientific. And I also heard names a lot over the years, especially in my early years. People said that my art reminded them of this guy named Miro from Spain. And also a guy named Paul Klee, K-L-E-E, who was a German or a Swiss-Austrian Cubist painter. And so I can see the connection with all these people, and other names would come up from time to time, like this South American painter named Mata. These really early fields of paintings I did after I just came back from the Esalen Institute were compared to him. And I just loved painting. And then ever since I parallel developed myself with my learning guitar and piano and writing about my travels and all different kind of stuff, and that brought me around 1990, I was able to start pretty much making a living from my art. And so I always gave away a lot, but I've been able to support myself from my art since then. And then in 1993, I was hitchhiking in Colorado, and we stopped by the Colorado River, and I just saw this big pile of rocks that had been dredged up, and I just was drawn to pick up three of them and put them in my pocket, not really thinking of anything except that they were cool. And I took them up to Park City, Utah, had them sitting on my desk there where I was already set up to paint. I was doing a lot of hand-painted t-shirts at the time. And I went out for a walk that afternoon into the countryside. This is near where the Cheyenne Indians lived on the border of Utah and Wyoming. And I really felt like the spirit of the Native American ancestors was just right there with me that day, very powerfully. And I came back and I sat down to paint and I looked at those rocks and I go, "Oh my God, I can paint on rocks." The Native American spirit gave me the idea, the gift of painting on rocks. And so I sat down and painted three in honor of the Native Americans. And I've still got one of those rocks with me right now here on Great Barrier that I added a little bit to. But that was the beginning of my rock painting. And now here in July of 2019, 26 years later, I've painted over 53,000 rocks. And in reading up on artists, I read that Paul Klee, in terms of the history of art, is typically regarded as being the most prolific of all modern artists because he painted over 8,000 works during his career that spanned how many decades. But each of my rocks is a unique little painting. Everyone is different, even though I might have done a dolphin 1,000 times and turtles 800 times and stuff like that. Each one is a unique little painting. And so the fact that I've painted over 53,000 rocks and probably at least 1,000 or more other paintings and other objects and stuff like that, maybe 2,000, that would put me up there with possibly having the Guinness Book of World Record title for the most prolific modern artist of the planet. And I've given away a lot of that. So then around 1990, I really started feeling a very strong connection with Down Under. And it seemed related. It was a feeling as much as anything that related to the calling I felt with the stars in 1968 and the calling I felt with the dolphins around the early 70s when I was in college. And I felt the same kind of calling from the indigenous people of Australia. And I really felt in my mind's eye in 1990 that indigenous elders from the central desert were sending out a calling to anybody who might be able to be sensitive enough to pick up on their broadcast, that their culture was, two things were important to know, that A, they were on the verge of going down and disappearing forever. They were just being driven into the ground of extinction by the white man and the encroaching civilization and all the stuff and deliberate genocide, which I had no idea about at the time. But part two was that they are the most ancient, continuously existing culture on this planet, and that their sacred ceremony, their rituals, their art goes back maybe 100,000 years or more, and it has to do with maintaining the sacred connection between water-based life on Earth and on other planets, in other star systems, other dimensions. Things I can't really comprehend, but it's a feeling that it seemed that all this was related. The stars, the whales and dolphins, the indigenous people of Australia, and life as we know her, and how precious they are, and how in danger they are. And all this has been the very central core of my whole life. And I've talked about some of this before. I call it the cetacean Kuringi Lawler Lily Narby Bielakowski hypothesis. Each of these people or beings represents a fundamental aspect. And I've added in Kluban Napier before Bielakowski in there because of the importance of the comets and asteroids and all this, and the inky window in which we still are in right now. So I really felt like ever since I came down under, my painting really went to the next level. It's like I was just being directly inspired by the dream time and the land and the people of Australia, both the European related people who gave me a lot of support and still do, and the indigenous people who I've gradually come to know really, really intimately. Many, many, many of the elders have my rocks and my art and bless what I do. And it's hard to explain, but I've just been infused with that whole energy. But it's a much bigger picture. It's global. It has to do with life and the whole planet and water and the stars and the whales and dolphins. And so this is the dominant themes that I paint. But I've come to understand that I think what I'm painting is much more than just pictures that are nice to look at. You know, some of them are more kind of ornamental than others, but the dominant theme that I paint is that each picture tells a story. And that story is very multidimensional. And a lot of these stories that I'm telling, that I'm expressing, I haven't even written up in words, but I'm doing a lot of paintings now that are astronomically related, that have the galaxy and star clusters and the points of origin, the radiants of the Taurid meteors that are believed to be related to Comet Encke, and whales and dolphins, and it just seems like that this energy is coming through me so strongly right now that it's the universe wants us to be very aware of this kind of thing. The universe is using me as a way to get the cosmic context, and especially the comets and the whales and dolphins and the origins and the fate and the future of life as we know her, that this is the most important thing that we should be aware of right now. And the universe is using me and my art as a way to try to get this out there. It's very interesting that in 2003, I was in Alice Springs and went in a gallery and showed him one of my painted rocks. And the guy goes, "Jeff, oh my God, you got to go meet the Keringe artist. That's Keringke. They're down in St. Teresa, about an hour from here, but you're doing the same thing." That's what he told me. So I got in touch and met Kathleen Wallace, the leader of the Keringe group, and we were blown away. They couldn't believe that I did what I did with brushes, and I couldn't believe that we were painting almost the same thing. Even though I had just come from America, had never heard of them, and as it turned out, I gave them a whole set of rocks painted with these glyphs that I started doing in Mullumbimby in 2002, or actually in 2000. I call it the Mullum Keringe glyphs because it's a whole new style of painting that looks like little rainbow-encoded symbols, but it's non-repeating. But it's kind of like a chromatic light language code that to me has to do with how life constantly creates new forms. And it's related to light. It's related to light, like the energy from the sun, the photons, and DNA, and water. I can't explain all this stuff, but it's all related. This is what's coming through in a lot of my art. And so the Keringe group does a lot of batiks, and they use these little dispensers that has a little metal tip and a little bubble that you squeeze out some paint that they use for batiking. So that was a very, very, very powerful connection. And Serena Hayes, when I looked at their book, she had done a little dot painting almost identical to one I had done in America after visiting an old growth forest called Joyce Kilmer National Park or Memorial Forest in Western North Carolina on the summer solstice of 1999. We did almost the exact same painting, and that really blew me away. I got invited to do my first murals in Australia in 2000 in Noosa, and I was getting close to finished. One of them was a seascape, and one of them was kind of like a Milky Way. And this guy came in, and he goes like, "Jeff, this looks like it was painted by an Aborigine scientist on acid." And I go like, "Wow, I like that, you know, that's me." So it's very interesting to think about pictures in the sense of, if you start reading up on communication with extraterrestrial intelligence, which I have a good deal of background in that area, especially in terms of people that I've been in touch with and communicated with over the years, like Arthur C. Clarke and Carl Sagan and Dr. John Lilly, whose dolphin group I worked with in California. But Sagan and Lilly both talked about how the most likely form that an extraterrestrially originating message would take would be a picture. And Lily and Lily's wife Tony talked about the dolphins transmitting images into their mind. And it's very, very interesting because right here on Great Barrier Island in October of 2015, I had an image transmitted into my mind telepathically by these dolphins I had just been swimming with that was an impression of what a comet or asteroid might look like during the split second as it was coming through the atmosphere on a trajectory directly towards me, the observer. And I'm actually painting that now. And so that's one of my most freaky and esoteric painting images. I'm turning it into kind of like a glyph. It's called the Ihi Inki glyph. So we've got sacred art and we've got secular art, or art that's done for purposes of ornamentation, rather than, I think of art as a form of internal technology. Now that's a very interesting, one of the most powerful ways to look at art, and that's it was a chapter in Jose Arguez's book, The Transformative Vision, Art as Internal Technology. So that's pretty much my philosophy of art, and again, you can look at it at like a mandala as being a form of internal technology, something that focuses your attention. Sand paintings, medicine wheels, my Mullum Karingi glyphs. Very, very, very interesting. But art is internal technology. To me, being an artist is not so much about the artifact or the quote-unquote art that's created. It's more about the process of being creative, which is our, to me, our creativity is our true spark of divinity, the true godliness in each of us. And I think every being, not just every life form, but every being, even this little piece of gravel beneath my toe, every blade of grass, every photon, every grain of sand, every drop of rain, every snowflake, has its own little unique creativity, because it may not have free will, but its uniqueness, its own individuality is, in a sense, its creativity. And we have different levels of creativity, and so people are always asking me that they go like, Jeff, I wish I was an artist. And I go like, but look, you are. Even if you've never taken the trouble to buy some paint or learn how to play an instrument or write some poetry or anything like that, you are your own work of art, because you have been exercising creativity at many, 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 many different levels for your whole life. Deciding whether you're going to put your foot here, you're going to put your foot there, deciding which side of your mouth you're going to chew your peanuts on, deciding what brand of soda pop you're going to drink, or whether you may choose not to put that in your body, who you're going to hang out with, if you're going to spend time watching television or go out and go on a bicycle ride, or if you're going to, what you're going to do with your life in the future. Are you going to become a doctor or a lawyer or an artist or an environmental activist or maybe an astronaut or a fireman or a nurse? And every millisecond we're using creativity in enormous ways that's so complex that we couldn't possibly keep track of it all if we had to. So we're each a walking miracle of internal technology, in the sense of all the myriad and astronomically complex processes that make us possible, but yet we don't have to be consciously aware of it. We don't have to be constantly monitoring it all. That's one of the biggest things that we have to be thankful for, is the fact that we can inhabit the ultimate technology without even knowing anything about how it actually works. But if you do start focusing some of your attention on how your own internal technology does work and what you've actually got, that helps you to take your whole ability to be here now to the next level. It helps you to really understand and appreciate who and what you are as a living human being and what we share in common with all other life forms, and the beauty and power of being here now as a truly creative participant observer in the whole spectrum, the continuum of reality as we know it. So I try to encode a bit of that in all of my art too. But you know, it's really interesting. I think if you're talking about the petroglyphs that we see on rocks, one of the main themes that a lot of people are pointing out is that many of them on different continents, I think Antarctica is the only continent that has no evidence of human habitation and therefore no rock art. But everywhere else, on every continent, you see petroglyphs that look like little men, but they actually look like the patterns that plasma creates when it discharges at different levels. But the fact that some of these look like people makes me wonder if the plasma discharge might not have something to do with the form that we currently inhabit as Homo sapiens. My friend Moira Timms told me that she thought that the Egyptian hieroglyphics weren't actually writing in the sense of the way that we use writing, that they actually were symbols for sounds, making them much closer to being like sort of a form of music notation than writing as we know it. So apparently Egyptian hieroglyphics, when they would stand there, they would say or sing them out loud. They wouldn't stand there and read them in silence. It would be sort of like reading the score to a symphony in silence. It's not something that you would do because it's not really what it is. I thought that was a very interesting insight. And we don't really understand the meaning of sand paintings, like the Navajo sand paintings, the Tibetan sand paintings. I met the Tibetan, the Jeto monks in Hobart about 3 years ago doing a sand painting. But they do the same design every year, and it's one that's thousands of years old, and it's very important that they not do it any differently. But I'm sort of exactly the opposite. I like for everything to be different every time, because that's kind of how life is. Like, every human being has more or less the same form, but we're each different. So every rock I paint is a rock, but each one's different, even if it has the same design that's recognizable. But I've never tried to paint stuff that's realistic. Like, if I paint a dolphin, you can tell that's what it's supposed to be, but it also doesn't look like one really looks. So I like abstract or non-representational art because it engages the mind and the creativity of the person looking at it in a different way than if it's got every little detail filled in for you. You're just sort of like consuming someone else's image. But if it doesn't have a previously existing template or category to fit into, in other words, if it's something you've never seen before or it doesn't really fit with anything that you would normally see, it sort of forces your brain to be creative in ways that looking at realistic photography and portraits and scientific illustration doesn't do. And if it's completely abstract fields, like the paintings that I did that are just sort of visual noise, like the guy that compared me to Kandinsky, that's where it's just like a projection screen. So you could think of it as a really sort of a very artistic Rorschach pattern. And also, I like for people to have my original art rather than a reproduction. I've never reproduced anything. And in some ways, it's very ironic and maybe even stupid for me to, as prolific of an artist as I am and with the talent I've got, or so people tell me, that for me to ever be poor or lacking in money, which I almost always am, and it's not just because I like to give so much stuff away, but I think it's much more powerful to own the original rather than a reproduction, because the original has the energy that I sat there with the whole time, you know. So it's not just purely about the visual image for the painting itself. One of the main things that I try to do with my art is to not only honor the tradition of painting of indigenous people, but to keep the spirit alive, to carry the torch of the indigenous ancestors whose painting carried sacred information about the connection with life. That's really what my art is all about, the most important thing. And it's to honor the beauty and power of being here now, to honor the beauty of nature, the patterns, the gracefulness of curves and the shapes and the colors. Color is so important to me. I try to put a full rainbow in every painting. I saw a rainbow on Aniwaniwa this morning, just after the sun came up. So, a lot of my art also, people said it looks like something under the microscope or something through the telescope, or it was done by an Aborigine scientist on acid, and I can see what they mean. But a lot of my art also owes a lot to scientific information display. All the graphs and charts and computer simulations and models that I've seen displaying visual information scientifically, but in a graphic form, that I've probably would have seen millions of those in my life. And so a lot of my art has that kind of, and also maps and charts, like star charts and maps of continents, like my paintings from a few years ago called The Shockers of the Rainbow Serpent. It shows the body of the rainbow serpent spiraling out from the most important to me power spots and vortices in Australia, and then extending over to New Zealand, Hawaii, and then down through the Americas, the chakras in the body of the rainbow serpent, and maps of the stars. Like, I'm doing a bunch of art right now that shows the radiance of the Inky, of the Taurid meteor stream, and the where the center of the galaxy is between Sagittarius and Scorpio, and Denawan, the Emu grandmother in the Milky Way that's sacred to the East Coast people of the Mount Yango area basin in northern New South Wales in the Blue Mountains, where I got to visit a couple of months ago. I also think about that my art is related to the Arecibo transmission that I mentioned before, but it could be that rather than the binary image that was sent out by Frank Drake through the Arecibo telescope, that what I'm painting is a response that's coming back through the whales and dolphins, through the consciousness of water and DNA and water-based life and all the ancestors of Australia and the Dreamtime. I'm painting the response to that message. Hundred Fosser, one of my favorite artists who lived here in New Zealand, had some very powerful observations to make on the importance of beauty and the absence of visual ugliness and the use of straight lines and right angles and stuff like that. So it's important to surround ourselves with beauty, but my art is very organic, and it's kind of like it fits in with nature, just like my flute playing. It blends with nature. It doesn't stand out. It doesn't stand out like the jackhammer, the chainsaw in the sky, airplane, the skill saw, the weed eater, or the bark muncher, or whippersnipper. My art blends with nature because it is a part of nature. I'm honoring the beauty and power of being here now. Anyway, we're all artists, and so I urge everyone, in the interest of re-navigating the human process, to strive to honor and nurture your own inner artist and become conscious of the creative process that you're using all the time, and be aware and give thanks. Walk in beauty with heartfelt gratitude for the power of the ultimate technology that you are. It's a lot of responsibility, but it's who we really are. It's time to seize the day and take the helm of being here now. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off here on Memory Island, Aotea. Live simply so that others may simply live. Good day.
Thank you. Thank you.